Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to University Challenge. Your starter for 10 is, which theme have we picked out here? Who are these strange beings? That was my Carl Sagan impersonation, just in case you didn't get it. This one is about the gaffer, whoever he may be. Pretty much every single soccer player we've spoken to had at least one incredible story about a manager that they'd played under. You are going to meet motivators, bullies, innovators and comedians. Sometimes that's all rolled into the one guy. We should start and finish with two people who played under Jose Mourinho. It's fair to say that Damien Duff and Kevin Bridges don't have too much else in common on the footballing front, except Kevin's got one hell of a right foot, Damien. Eh? In between these two, Chris Waddle tells us what he now sees as the method behind the bullying of Arthur Cox at Newcastle United. Gary Mack will tell us how Howard Wilkinson transitioned Leeds United from a second division outfit to one capable of winning the English title. Joe Jordan shows us the revolutionary preparations that Don Revie undertook. Peter Beardsley rooms with his Fulham manager, Kevin Keegan, in a flat above the chairman's shop. Can you guess where it is now? Who lives in a shop like this? Graham Souness hears a rare team talk from Joe Fagan, and Terry Butcher nearly kills Bobby Robson. I wasn't taking you up for leaving. You'll be aware that Jose's emphasised this recently by saying that side, you, and he names you, killer instinct. He said the Chelsea that he was sacked from, the Chelsea that he came back to, didn't kill games. And he said, you know, that's what we did, that's what Damien Duff did. And he talked about your attitude, he talked about your fearlessness, he talked about the fact that if you could get on a team and do a team and win. And that's him still talking about it all these years later. So all I meant was, it was no way derogatory about the decision to leave. I didn't know about that meeting, but when he said you'd be in my team, he meant it, and he still feels that way. And I think that's a major, major, you can't put it in the bank praise. And I think maybe through your career, that's not been the thing you've sought most, but it's pretty sincere, it's pretty serious praise from him.
For me,
I could put you in a situation you don't like.
No.
I just said it, and then I've done
it. Listen, for me, I love the man. Like, yeah, in the end, I said, listen, good luck, I'm out of here. But listen, the best 2 years ever working, I'm just...
Was it fun on a daily basis?
Yeah, he's a funny guy, for starters. But, like, coaching, training sessions, unbelievable. Like, frightening. Improved everyone no end. Like, it was more or less the same squad he inherited from Ranieri. I think he had a couple of additions. Obviously, Drogba struggled, really, for the first year.
He wanted to go home.
But he just turned us into winners just straight away. That arrogance, that confidence just rubbed off on everyone. And just, I said, steamroll the league for a couple of years. And the thing, obviously, whether I want to go into coaching or managing, the fact him leaving Chelsea this year and looks like he's lost the dressing room, I just find that staggering. Just, there's no hope for any of us if he's losing the dressing room.
We're into an area where I need to be careful because I didn't play for him. If the people who play tell me it correctly, then maybe there's been a change in the man, a change in him. Yeah. That as phenomenal as he is, his human being, and I think in his attitude to playing and to life and to, and also the dark arts, sometimes if you wear the Lord of the Rings, if you wear the ring too long, it corrupts you. I think maybe some of those who encountered him when he came back to Stamford Bridge that second time found a change. So maybe I can put it down to the fact that it's not that you know, something ridiculous has happened because Chelsea have lost a guy who's still the guy he was in 2004-05-06 is my interpretation. We all do that. We all change for better or worse. And maybe it's going to give us all a treat where maybe he's in control of one half of Manchester next season and then Guardiola's in charge of the other half, which...
Well, yeah, if I was a betting man, no doubt he has to end up there, especially after Guardiola's rival going to City. I said the only statement Man United can make is him, and anyone else would be wrong for me. I said there's only one man for the job there, it's him.
Your talent was really clear throughout your school years, and then it sort of, you know, it didn't happen because Coventry thought maybe you were, I don't know, too small or whatever, which is, you know, because your height now, it's hard to understand. But a guy I want to ask you about, because he's very proud of your development, is Arthur Cox. And what fascinates me is that, you know, he says he bullied you.
Did.
Why did he bully you? And could somebody do that these days?
He bullied us because he could see the talent I had. And he used to think he thought I probably had an attitude problem. I didn't have an attitude problem. I was shy, very shy. And he thought I had an attitude problem because it looked like I wasn't interested because I never spoke. So he must have thought, he's not bothered. When you come out of a factory work to go to a professional, and all of a sudden you're training with professionals who you're probably watching or reading about in the local papers, and all of a sudden you're training with them from a non-league setup to that, you're just sort of thrown in. I mean, that's why I can see a lot of young players who get pushed aside and disregarded and said, no, you just ain't got it. If you go on trial, I'm going on trial at Sunderland, it's 18, 19, and I was petrified, you know, training with these pros and who you've been
watching.
It's
intimidating, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And you always get one or two nice lads who will come up and say, how are you, and, you know, enjoying it. If you know, most of them just take it as if they think, well, easy, you know, you sort of go in there and you don't know what you're doing because they are natural. They come in, the kit's there, they put it on, they do this, they sit there. To you, it's like, what is this, you know? And it was just shyness, really. And I think Arthur got the wrong end of where he'd come in. Obviously, he took over from Bill McGarry, and you know, the team was struggling. And he looked at the reserves, and I was just starting out, and I was on fire in the reserves. Pre-season, I found hard because it was the first pre-season I've ever done where you just thought, wow. I always said pre-season was ridiculous. The way they ran you, Mo Farah wouldn't do as many miles as what we did. And it was when I went to France, it opened my eyes up about pre-seasons. But this was just like slog. You know, and I found it hard. I was still developing. I was skinny. I grew working in the fact that from 16 to 18, I grew it to my height, but I was like a rake. And he must have looked at this kid and thought, doesn't say anything, gets on with it, but lacks a bit of confidence. But to him, it was, maybe he thought, he's not that bothered.
What did he do?
Everything was basically on my case. Whatever I did, I couldn't do anything right. When I was in training, you know, I'd go past two blokes and score, and he'd go, you don't do it enough. It's not good enough. You do it every now and again. It's not good enough. Or your final pass, or your final cross, or your final shot, or whatever you did, if you did it right, it was, you don't do it enough. And if you didn't do it right, obviously you lost the ball, it would be, there you go again. It was just, whatever you did, you just thought, if I scored two, should have scored three. Eight great crosses in, should have been nine. So it was never a pat on the back. It was always, could do more. Always could do more. And for 2.5 years, this was basically the life of... I used to hide in the training ground. I used to come in and I used to sneak in the changing rooms. I never used to go through because he'd pick on us for anything. So it was like basically at school, somebody grabbing you every day and taking your pocket money off you. He'd fine us for the slightest things.
Why didn't that break you?
Because I believed I had the ability. And by the way, there's a lot of times I spoke to like some of the older players and I used to say, I've had enough of him. I don't know whether to put a transfer request. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm sick of it. And it went, you know, and then Kevin Keegan came, you know, and then we got promoted. It was basically that year we got promoted. So it was like 2.5 years into of playing, where he actually came up with one day and he went, pennies dropped. But then after that was sort of I don't want you to take your foot off the gas. You know, that type of thing. But he says, the pennies drop, you're consistent now.
For him, that must have been a big thing for him to say.
Yeah. You know, it was like, what, you're actually praising us? It took 2.5 years to get a pat on the back. And he just said, you've got the consistency now. You've got, what he might have thought was attitude of, doesn't matter if it happens, doesn't matter. It did matter to us. But maybe it's my body language and the way I was. Maybe that he thought I wasn't as interested or as focused or the passion and desire, what you need to go and succeed in football. I did have it. It was just I was shy. But he obviously took it the other way.
This is out of equilibrium because it's going to be far more pleasant for me than it is for you. And I know that from experience because, Gary, you've always been able to talk as interestingly and intelligently and elegantly about football as you were able to play it. That's not final because you're going to go on and improve that over the next hour. But I've always thought, or certainly it's intrigued me, I grew up, what I mean, mad about Aberdeen, which I still am, even madder as I get older and stupider, because of Eddie Gray, mostly, really.
Yeah, yeah.
To a less extent, Joe and Billy Bremner and Harvey, and I like Leeds.
Yeah.
At a time, I felt like the only person outside Leeds in those days who liked Leeds because they. And I don't know if it's because Leeds' triumphs in Dunrevy's day were resented. I've always felt your league title, and let's underline that, you worked in a Leeds team that was champions of England. I've never felt that there's as much affection and reminiscence about a damn good team, certainly a damn good midfield. Do you think I'm onto something there that maybe it's slightly underappreciated?
No, I absolutely agree with you 100%. You know, I don't think Howard Wilkinson has ever got the acclaim that he should have. He's the last English manager to win it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the way he put it together, the way he got himself out of the old second division, he got Vinnie Jones in, Chris Kamara, they come in, did a job, but instantly realised how great a job they did to get the club back into the top league for the first time. I think there was 8 or 9 years of absence away, that things needed to change. They needed a different type of player to then carry on a threat into the top division. And that was pretty clear. He made that pretty clear. You know, he says, you're coming here and you'll probably replace Vinnie, who's been brilliant to me, and if you can equal what he did, you'll done a great job. And that was a drive. And the first person that welcomed me here, you know, not a million miles away from where we're sat right now, was Vinnie Jones.
Huh.
And he knew I was brought in to replace him. But it tells you a little bit something different about the guy. You know, he was a humble fella. And he sent a car to pick me up. And he showed me the city in one failed swoop, you know, which ended up maybe in a late bar that evening. But he was, that's the type of guy Vinnie was. It was a realisation that his type of player was needed to get Leeds out of the old second division. But then there was going to be a wee change on how Leeds were going to approach, you know, attacking the old first division.
Yeah, there I was going to segue into, because I have a fascination about Don. And because you were there, because Eddie Gray, I thought, was, when I was growing up, I thought was a genius. I would have paid everything I ever had to watch Eddie Gray play because he was so good. But when you throw in yourself and eventually David Harvey and Gordon McQueen, Peter Lorimer, it leads what a side I followed all the time, right from my earliest days. But I never really understood, I haven't really understood Don Revie well, and didn't know until very recently that as a footballer himself, before we even talk about what he was as a leader or an organiser or a builder of a club and a coach, that he'd been a very, very good player. He was a Football Writers Player of the Year in 55 at City. Described, I never saw it obviously, as a sort of Hidiguti, deep-lying striker.
Yeah.
That there's nothing new under the sun. We all got very excited about Messi being moved deep. And so if Bobby was his representative on the pitch, describe the man that you met who signed you, having seen you playing at centre-half for Morton against Jeff Assel in a friendly, which would have been an experience at the time.
Yeah, it would have been. It was the first and only time I played centre-half, but I think he came with Morris Lindley that night. I'll never forget it. Anglo Scottish singing. I must have done all right. I think we got a draw. But he was a meticulous guy. Someone that had a presence. Never missed a trick. Knew everything that was going on. Somebody you would play for. Someone who you would trust. Someone you thought would he'd look after you. Loved his football. Loved his team. Loved his players. He got a little bit of criticism, I suppose you could call it criticism, for his thoughts and his actions and his preparations on the opposition. I never thought that was a big deal, you know. I think it was exaggerated a bit. He did pay respect to the opposition, but not...
Could you explain what you mean by that? Because there'll be a lot of people don't understand what he might have been criticised for in terms of his preparation?
Well, like I think when he went to England and all these other players, they hadn't come across it before, where there was maybe a dossier on a player or a dossier on the team, an insight into who you were playing against and how they played, what their strengths were, what their weaknesses were. And Don had that, but I can't really remember sitting down and getting a dossier in writing. He may have done it when he went to England. Maybe these players were there for 3 or 4 days. He maybe thought he had to get it in reprint. But I do remember sat there. We would have a pre-match meal. I think it was the Manor House in Leeds. And then we'd come back down Ellen Road and we would be in the lounge. He had a players' lounge in Ellen Road and we'd all sit down. He would be announced. He would go, and then he would eventually announce the team. But he would get us in there and watch the TV or lead up to grandstand, whatever it was. And then he would talk through the game that they were going to get involved in at 3 o'clock. And he would maybe enlighten you on what he thought you needed to know regarding the opposition, whether it was an individual or what they were going to face as a player or as a team, you know. And, but that's taken for granted now. But he did that.
It is now, Joe. But I'm listening to what you said about Bobby and Eric, what you learned, the habits you learned at Morton. Although this was a big step for even a talented young man, it was still a big step you'd made. I imagine that when these things were happening and he was briefing you all, at the time it made perfect common sense to you that you would prepare. Is that fair, or was it kind? Did it feel a bit new and odd?
Not really, because when I went to Leeds, everything at Leeds was professional. It was the way that, and I wouldn't know. I couldn't really compare it with all I could compare with Morton. And I've got to say, Morton were all right, but I was a part time at Morton, and I was only full time for 2 or 3 months, but everything at Morton was fine. But when I went to Leeds, everything was professional. Everything was, what had to be done, was done. It was run with the same habits and disciplines that Don Revie gave to the players, and the players took that on board when they crossed the line. And I think that was one of their big strengths, you know, to be, because now, again, as time is showing there. And unless you have these values in a football team and club, you cannot be successful. And you cannot be successful for a period of time. You have got to have a philosophy. You've got to have a way of playing. You've got to have a way of running the club. And until that's sorted out, you might get an odd break where you get a cup or something like that, but you will not have consistency. You will not be competing year in, year out. You might not win. But the great thing about Leeds United was, and it's unfortunate in a way, was because they came second numerous times, but the following year, they were there again. They competed, and the knockback that they'd had, they got up, and they would go again. And that was down to the determination and the way things were run by Don Revie.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I remember Walter Smith saying to me one day, "Don't get Jim angry," and Fergie saying the same. Mm-hmm. I remember Stuart Baxter, who managed Finland and South Africa, and it was at Dundee United a little while before he went south, and he said that Jim literally scared the shit out of him. Mm-hmm. And was a violent, raging maniac. And he formed part of the new firm, broke the old firm, took Dundee United within inches, I think they were cheated, mm-hmm. of the European Cup final against mm-hmm. Liverpool. And you and he had ups and downs. Frankie's question. Paddy Connolly, Jim McLean.
Paddy was a teammate of mine at Dundee United and still a very good friend of mine, actually. One of my best friends in football, to be fair. And I think there was a common bond between a lot of the younger players at Dundee United because of the environment that we were in. You know, it was a very harsh environment. It was not harsh in terms of the day-to-day of being a professional footballer, of course. That's not harsh. But in terms of, you know, the level of criticism, you know, and you know how you were treated when you at times when you're out of the team was so harsh at times, and you felt so you never got a valid reason, you know what I mean? You could just be cast aside. Sometimes you were cast aside for months. You know, I was cast aside for about 7 months at Dundee United, where I barely played a game over a contract dispute. You know, I was in the last year, just totally cast aside. And Jim McLean, you know, he goes back to the era of the great Scottish Steen, obviously. You know, like, Jim McLean was our Jock Steen's assistant, I think, in the 82 World Cup, isn't that correct?
Yeah,
so, I mean, that showed the regard that Jock Steen had for Jim McLean. And Jim McLean was a genius in many ways. He was ahead of his time. You know, he always looked at every angle to try and make things better, you know what I mean? Like, when you look back, like, sports science, strength conditioning, psychology, we were exposed to all of those things at Dundee United. All of them. We trained hard. We were given, you know, we were constantly from above, you know, yous don't do enough, yous are too privileged, you're constantly that, you were hit with that constantly, you know what I mean? You need to do more. And in many ways, it was right. The only problem was the delivery of the message was always so harsh. And how it was delivered to you is that you probably, if it had been delivered with a little bit more softer touch to it, a little bit more empathy with you, you know, I know you're going through a tough time here, but we can get you. It was always done in such a harsh way that, you know, players tended to drift away from it. From a club point of view, like Jim, I mean, basically as a manager, you couldn't have, he created the perfect situation. You know, he had long-term contracts for players. The players who played in the team got the most money. Mm. So we had always got that stranglehold. Like, there was no one at Dundee United strolling about on big wages not contributing, like what you get in the modern game now. And he put that all together. You know, he gave himself such a amount of control at the club that through the contractual situation, obviously the board situation, all of those kind of things, that basically it was his club. It was his club. And so how he managed the players, he was answerable to no one, really. In relation to that, you know, it wasn't as if you were in a situation to say, well, I think I've been harshly treated here by the manager, I might, you know, speak to the board or whatever. That didn't exist. You just were like, you were harshly treated, get on with it.
I take you back to playing for Fulham and moving in with the boss.
Yes.
Being a squatter.
Unbelievable.
In a flat above Harrods.
Incredible.
It's alleged that your duties were the cooking.
Absolutely.
I want to know, what did you cook? What was your speciality dish? And what does King Kevin like to eat of a Thursday night? Baked beans on toast or what?
I tell you what's the funniest of all, Graham. You know London very well, so you know where we are.
Knightsbridge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
Unbelievable. Honestly, incredible. Obviously, Kevin was the manager. I was a player. Wasn't a coach. I was a player.
Yeah.
But I had the chance to live with him. So on a Monday morning, we would get the train from Newcastle. So I would get the 6 o'clock train. It would be 6:30 at Darlington. So he got on his Darlington. We arrive into London at 10 to 9, get the tube across London into the training ground. And then that was us for the rest of the week. So training ground Harrods. So anyway, what happened was, basically, he said, you're in charge of food, Pedro. So I could stay at the training ground all day and he would have meetings with Mr. Fayed. But there would be times when, not bored, but I didn't need to be in the meeting or whatever, or I didn't think it was my place, so I would go back. So you know where I am. I was walking along Cromwell Road to Sainsbury's, which is by the Marriott Hotel, 24 hours
on passes. the red line where the cars was by. It's right across the Marriott.
So I'm going there to get the food, right? So whatever it may be, you like the steak, so anyway. So obviously I'm doing that, and to be fair to him, a lot of times, Graham, it's almost a myth in the sense that we just go out, because where we are in Harrods, you literally go anywhere and have a meal, and I don't mean that in a horrible way. So anyway, we're doing this. But anyway, he said to me one day, he said, Pedro, what's the story with the food? Where are you getting the food from? I said, well, Sainsbury's that we drive past to on the training ground, on the training ground run, on the right, you know, about a mile up the road. You're kidding me. I said, well, not in a horrible way. Where the fuck am I supposed to get? So anyway, he said, I've got a Harrods card. So like, wow, you're telling me, I've been there 3 months, walking up and down this road. I've got a Harrods card.
Hold on. Not with two shopping bags and a ball.
To be fair, I didn't have a ball this time. I did have the bags. That was when they give you bags for free.
Yeah.
But no.
You could have earned caviar on toast every night. And
so, to be fair, Graham, every Friday, if we were at home, Sandra would bring my two kids down. So my two kids at the time, Graham, were probably 8 and 4 or 9 and 5. So what she used to do, so my kids went to school in Jesmond in Newcastle. As soon as they come out of school, she used to go across Newcastle, get onto the train and come down. For that weekend, we would live in the same flat as Kevin Keegan. And he would be doing tricks with my kids. Stupid tricks, like Tommy Cooper tricks. And honestly, like wearing coats and like the old Tommy Cooper trick where you pull the coat and like the coat comes off and your shirt's still on. And wow, unbelievable. Honestly, did some unbelievable things and just treat them like kings, honestly. But on a Saturday morning, we used to go across the Harrods for my pre-match breakfast on Kevin's card. So that was about the best thing I got of it.
Cornflakes and quail's eggs.
To be fair, yeah. Cornflakes, I wouldn't go for quail's eggs. No, it was bacon and eggs. That for my routine, Graham, for almost 20 years would have been bacon and eggs breakfast.
Yeah.
No pre-match, bacon and eggs breakfast. And orange juice.
You haven't done too badly on it.
No. Yeah. I'm eating too many Mars bars now, but apart from that...
Yeah, sorry about the Toblerone.
So anyway, come on, get to the game. We've never mentioned Roma. We're playing Roma in Rome.
We're Liverpool.
They've got World Cup winners. They've got Cherezo and Falcao, two great Brazilian midfield players. So we've never mentioned them. So the Tuesday night before the Wednesday game, we arrive at Tuesday afternoon, train in the stadium on the Tuesday night. We go to bed. I'll tell you the full story because I think it is quite how we describe it. Kenny and I are in the room together. So we get into bed, sensible. The telly's blaring next door, so banging on the wall, nothing. I go out, bang on the door, nothing. Phone down, someone comes up to try, nothing. So eventually we get to sleep. Wake up in the morning, Wednesday morning, we're coming out our room, and the person coming out the room next door where all the noise was our manager. It was Joe Fagan. I said, boss, I said, you kept us awake all night. He said, sorry, boys, we opened the second bottle of scotch last night. It was a long night. So then, that's the Wednesday morning. So they've arranged a training ground for us, which we turn up and it's a ploughed field, so we don't train. Then we come back, so we don't train, we just have a walk. We come back to the hotel, we're having our lunch. Joe stood up, tapped his glass, asked the waiters to leave, and we're all nudging ourselves saying, what's he going to say? Because we never had team meetings. No one ever spoke. We've not mentioned Roma. So he stood up and we're all nudging, what's he going to say? So he stood up and he was looking up at the ceiling and he said, big game tonight. These are a good team. They must be a good team. Won the championship last year, final the European Cup. He's talking to himself. And then he said, can't be as good as us. Now, the bus leaves at 5:30. Make sure no one's late. That was the team talk. Never knew it. We didn't know. We never spoke about their players. We knew they had some big players. And we went out, and they were frightened to death of us. We played them off the park.
Was he much of a disciplinarian?
He was. He was quite tough. Sometimes
really?
Very tough, yeah. Very tough. I mean, I remember 1990 in the World Cup. There's a great story about with Gazza and Chrissy Waddle where we've organised a players' night out. This is like 4 days before the Republic of Ireland game in Sardinia. So me and Chris Woods did a bit of a recce a few days before, found the bar. So he said to Chrissy Waddle, come on, Chrissy Waddle and Gazza, come on, let's go down there for a few drinks. So the word got about, and in the end, it was about 9 or 10 of us, like John Barnes and Brian Robson and everybody else. Chris Woods was my roommate, so we all went down, organised the cars, got down there, and came back. as we came back at midnight, wherever it was, you know, because you think you're invisible, I had a good few, about 6 or 7 pints, because it was a bit stir crazy in the World Cup prior to the first game. Brian Robson's gone up to Gazza's room, tried to lift his bed, and as he's lifted his bed, the bed that Gazza's on, Gazza fell out of bed, the bed's slid along the tile floor and took his right toenail half off. His right foot, his big toenail.
Yeah.
Blood everywhere. Gazza says, stick it in the bidet. So Brian Pop puts it in the bidet, and Gazza turns on the hot tap, which made it even worse. So then the doctors have to be called. We're all asleep, oblivious. So anyway, the next morning, 8:30, Donho on the door, team meeting, and I'm like, oh, we've been rumbled here, because you've got a bit of a thick head. So we go over there and team meeting, and Bobby went right through us. He went right through us. You have wrecked your chances. The captain of your country could be out of the World Cup. How am I going to explain that to the press? He says, I'm going to go in the room next door and I want you all to come through in that room. He said, all come through, those that were out. He says, and apologise to me and apologise to your country. So I said, oh, right. So I said to Woody, come on, Woody, we're going. He says, I'm not going. I said, well, you're not going. He says, all right for you. He says, you've had an international career. Mine could be over. He said, I've not had one yet.
Smart man.
So where do you think? I'm going to go through. So I went through to the next door. And I had a bit of a beard at the time because I think I was on the verge of not playing and all that sort of thing in the World Cup, 1990. So, because Mark Wright was there and Des Walker was there. And so it was a really good squad.
Yeah.
So I go through. And then Chrissy Waddle standing behind Bobby Robson with Gazza. Bobby Robson sat down because they've been in first and they've obviously sat. So Bobby Robson went through me. I knew it would be you. You're always a ringleader. You've got this problem with alcohol and that. So he went through me and I said, I'm really sorry, Gaffer, and all that sort of thing. And humbly apologised, which I did and all that sort of thing. And then Gaz is behind the gaffer and he's making faces at me. I'm getting angry and he's being some stupid face, so I start laughing. And that made Bobby worse because it's not a funny thing. It's no laughing matter, Butcher, and all this. So anyway, he finished it off. He said, and what his finishing line was, and another thing, Butcher, you're ugly. Of course, Gazza and Chrissy Waddle just burst out laughing. And he says, right, now go, clear off, and bring the next ones in. And I don't know who else came. Gazza went out before me, and I've chased Gazza around the pool trying to kill him. I got hold of him eventually and batted him, but
only Bobby could go.
Only Bobby did that. There was an expletive there, so I didn't put it in. And you're beep, beep, ugly. But he used to, he was so funny. Some of the things he used to say would just make you laugh. He didn't deliberately be funny, but sometimes he used to say the funniest things and we'd be rolling around laughing.
What was it with him in names? How on earth? You know, because he was a bright, intelligent, curious man. Look what the heck he did in having gone abroad and won trophies in Portugal, Holland, Spain. But he couldn't get names. Did that not seem a bit strange? The famous one is that he's manager of England.
In the lift.
Brian's captain of England. Bobby comes down and, morning, Bobby.
No, morning, Brian. Morning, Bobby.
Morning, Bobby, and Brian's like, no boss.
Yeah.
I'm Brian, you're Bobby.
That's true. Because he used to, there's another story about him in the World Cup in 1986. He went to Colorado Springs for high altitude training, the Air Force Academy. Base and all that sort of thing, Top Gun base. So we're there and having a great time, fantastic facility. He comes along, he says, I forgot my boots. Everybody got size 9 boots, that they're spare ones. So Glenn Oldham said, yeah, I've got a brand new pair, Bobby. Boom, Adidas, I think they went through him and he caught it. So we do a 2-hour session, which we were doing then to acclimatise for Mexico. And Bobby comes back in, he says, threw him back at Glenn. He says, they're never 9. He says, that's a number upside down, it should be 6. She says, you're joking, they're brand new. He says, I know, but my feet, you're killing me. So Glenn has a look, and because they're brand new boots, in the boots is still the paper. And Bobby had read about the whole training session with the paper in the boots. It was sensational. I mean, they're legendary tales. But the players love him more for it, because at the end of the day, he doesn't mean to be funny. And some of the things he said and did, honestly, are priceless. They really were. But that bonded you towards him even more, because it was like, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, sort of thing.
One man in this room has been coached by Jose Mourinho.
That's right.
Did you make your peace with him after Seville? And did you see a different side of the Jose Mourinho that I saw when he was the Real Madrid manager and he was caught up in Machiavelli and stuff? He was an angry man in those days.
The soccer aid thing, the offer came in. My agent phoned me up and just goes, do you play football? And I was just going, well, I play a bit of five-a-sides.
at goals in Drumchapel. What do you mean by football? And he's going, it's basically soccer aids every 2 years and they're looking for like a rest of the world, celebrities and ex, whatever. So I'm always a bit like celebrity stuff. It's like, I don't really see myself as that. Anyway, that's my own sort of
hang up.
Neurosis or whatever you want to call it. I said, who's playing? I don't want to hear the celebrities. Who's the footballers? And he's going, Clarence Seedorf, Edwin van der Star, Jaap Stam, Alessandro Del Piero, Andrei Shevchenko, coached by Mourinho. And he goes, they'll need you for training for 4 days and then the game on the Sunday. And I'm going, wow, obviously I'll play. I've never been on an 11-a-side pitch before, except for a few daft kickabout games and like other comedy festivals and stuff. So I signed up for it. You're thinking, like, surely Mourinho's not going to show up every day. So we got there on the Monday, it was a welcome night. I get in the lift, I dump my bags in the hotel, get told the penthouse of the hotel was the welcome drinks night. Dump my bag, get in the lift. The lift door opens, I went to walk out, presuming it was my floor. And it was Mourinho and his assistant kind of looking about a bit lost. And I was like, never knew what to say. I was just going, Josie. And he goes, are you going to the penthouse? And I was like, yes, mate, the soccer aid, because I had the polo shirt on. And he's in the lift, just kind of, I was like, looking forward to this week. And he's going, ah, yeah, it should be fun. It's a bit of small talk. I thought that'd maybe be the last I would see him, but the next day, he's there every day training, first guy there, doing the training drills. I had quite a tight hamstring, right? So I had to tell the physio that I'd been trying to get fit for it, and then trying to get fit, I'd end up even less fit. I'd pulled a muscle or whatever. Much. So I get told I had an underactive glute, and I couldn't train. An underactive glute. That's something my mom would call me when I was refusing to get out of bed. So I had to get acupuncture and... It was Fulham's training ground. So the physios are like, putting needles in. I'm, even the novelty of that, like, and Jamie Redknapp, he was getting treatment. There we go. Stereotypes. He was getting the treatment beside me. So I'm on the treatment table and just, wow. A bit of you is going, right, the novelty of getting treatment wears off pretty fast when Mourinho's out there taking a training session. So on the last day, I managed to get training. And I scored a goal, right? But it was only because I'd maybe doing myself a discredit. In the training, Mourinho was like, showing us how to take an offensive corner, right? So, how to take it out. Basically, an offensive corner's in defence. We're working on the defence, and then a corner was coming in, so I was in the team, like the non-bib, so it's our team's corner. So he's telling me where I have to be. He's showing me these notepads and stuff, but it's, I'm like, I can't believe you're talking to me, mate, rather than following his instructions. So I never knew what to do, right? So Seedorf's taking the corner, and I'm going, what do you say when you're looking for the ball? It's not like goals on a Tuesday night in Drumchapel shouting Craigie or something. So I'm going, what do you say? So I'm going like, Clarence. And before it was even up my mouth, he just zinged this past to me. And it was coming far too. I'm panicking, I'm not able to control this. So I only because I hadn't followed Mourinho's instructions, I'd came short for the corner rather than go to the edge of the box. It's just knackered to even get into the box. So Mourinho, he must have thought I went against him. But maybe I liked that, expressing myself a wee bit, right? So I've shouted Clarence. He's knocked the ball to me. So I feel like a kind of angle just to the right of the goal. I've kind of curled it up. And it's been, I've just hit it because I was panicking about being unable to control it. So I've just put a toe through it, but it's been right up.
Oh, you
like a Beckham, right in the side net on the far away goal. In the net, everybody's cheering.
Goal,
I swear to God, this happened. I know it seems
century.
Like bullshit. I think it was on the highlights package, right? On the build up show. They're all applauding. Mourinho's going, where has that been all week? My secret weapon. And all that. I can't believe it. Clarence has given me a high five. A nice goal, man. But I didn't want to tell them, obviously. So in the canteen afterwards, Van der Sar walks up and he goes, nice goal, man. And I was like, oh, cheers, Edwin. And he's going, it's hard to read the mishits. I'm going, you big prick. And so I mentioned the two Nakamura put by him and he's laughing. But anyway, I sat beside Mourinho on the bus up from London to Manchester on the day of the game.
Where you play at?
Old Trafford.
Old Trafford.
So on the Saturday, it was funny. Noticed. Mourinho was telling us that anybody that's late on the bus at Chelsea, they just get told to get a taxi. The bus leaves on time, no matter where they... So we're waiting for ages. Nobody knows who we're waiting on. Mourinho, he sits at the back of the bus, which I quite liked, rather than the gaffer at the front. One of the BAM fans sits up the back. So he's going, who are we waiting on, man? Fucking hell, who are we waiting on? And it turns out it was Adam Richman for Man vs. Food.
Okay.
So he walks on, and Mourinho sees it was... He's going, fucking hell, I thought we were waiting on Maradona. So like, he's quite sharp, but... I'm sitting beside, I was on like the aisle seat, he was on the other aisle seat. So it's like a 5-hour bus journey. And we just get talking about became like a Q&A sort of thing, just asking him about. I was showing him my football manager on my iPad. I was managing a wee non-league team called Workington in the Blue Square North, but it was in like season 2035, so I'm showing Mourinho and he's laughing. I was like, look, they've shown him the news and they said they'd built a statue of me and all that sort of stuff, and he's going, 2035? I'm like, mate, I'm a legend. I'm showing him like, the history. I'd won 5 European Cups. How many of you done, Jose? And he's laughing. Then I was showing him my tactics and how I like to keep the team like pressing, keep the passes short. Mm-hmm. And he's asking me, if you're playing pressing football, the players need to be fit. I'm going, of course, man. Like, you're talking to a guy that's won 5 European Cups, Jose. But showing him all the players' stamina is at 20, that's the highest attribute. And then he was just laughing and he showed me his iPad with all the match data and stuff for Chelsea that season, or how in-depth it is. But just a real thing, he knew I was into my football and stuff like that, so it was really phenomenal just to
see
that.
Eh?
Yeah, it's fair to say Kevin's football career didn't really reach the heights that was promised by that scorcher he scored against Edwin van der Sar. But you'll go a long way before you find a better storyteller in these parts or anywhere in the world. We all hope you enjoyed not just Kevin's great tales, but all of those accounts of managers who found different ways to create indelible memories in the minds of our guests. The Big Interview is produced by Backpage and me. The music is by Beer Jacket, and it's blimmin' good. There are more new interviews on the way very soon. For now, thanks for being there. Thanks for listening. We do this for you. We do this for you. We do this for you, our lovely audience. We do this for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.